So we have a really exciting one for you guys today. We were finally able to sit down with Art O'Connor. Many of you will know him as Wukar. We had a really great interview. We're going to record the kind of front end of the episode here. We're in the car. I didn't feel like plugging the mics back in. Apologies for the poor audio quality. But we did have a couple things, business end of this week, we wanted to go into. The first, and he's too humble to talk about it, so I will. Dan did his Weverest, Zwift Everest a couple days ago. Some of you went and cheered him on. It was really cool to see. That took you just shy of 17 hours, right?
I think so, in writing time, yeah. Yeah, but, you know, and the thing I didn't realize it was actually a thing. While I was doing it, there were several other people Zweveresting too. And it was kind of cool to see them finishing, and it made me realize it was possible. But, I mean, I felt kind of like it was a kind of lame thing. Wasn't super cool, but I was really inspired by like the Gibbons and Helena and Amy Larkin for doing La Ruta. And I just felt like I needed to do something big. But then I got realizing that all those guys did something big that was actually cool. And
yeah, you did like the lamest version of a cool thing, huh?
Yeah, kind of. I was like, but it really wasn't too bad. It was kind of fun. I actually did enjoy it. I thought it was a lot more pleasant than I was thinking it was going to be. You know, I just watched some movies and yeah, it was good.
Well, very well done to you.
We also had, on the same day, we had Max Miles. Did you see what he did?
I saw the 12-hour Zwift.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, 90 minutes on Zwift for the Maybird rides feels long to me. That was cool to follow.
That was super cool. And let me just say, I usually don't recommend, I think like 3 hours on Zwift
is a ridiculously huge amount.
Yeah, I think most of your Zwift rides, 90 minutes is great. So I really don't recommend anyone do what Max and I did Saturday, but I don't know.
Hey, sometimes you're like, you know what I need to do today? 17 hours on Zwift. I need to do 2 transatlantic flights over Zwift is what my mental health needs right now. So well done to you guys. We also finished running group right before this interview. That was great. We had a
great
huge turnout.
Super fun.
Really, really cool. And those are every Monday at 4:30?
Yep.
Every Monday at 4:30. Keep an eye out for those. Definitely come along. I can tell you is the, I don't know what the antonym of accomplished is, but I am whatever that adjective is as a runner. And I felt, you know, that you don't need to be a pro. There's very fast people, very slow people who show up to these. You know, Dan comes. You're not going to be slower than him.
Yeah.
So definitely be sure to catch us next week if you haven't come. They're a lot of fun. And then, of course, we'll have the Team Zwift ride this Wednesday at 6 o'clock. Plan on 90 minutes for that. Again, there's the total range. You're not too fast or too slow for it. Tons and tons of fun.
They are really fun. I think I'll be able to sit on a saddle again by then.
Oh man, this guy is this. You're what? Are you like saddle sore patient zero now?
Actually, I'm not really that saddle sore, and I feel pretty good. So, yeah, I'm. I think I'll be ready to ride here soon. So,
well, anything we're missing?
No. Today's episode, it was just awesome to be able to sit down and talk with one of my heroes, Art. It was a really, really good conversation. It's just fun. It's really fun to pick Art's brain. He's really interesting guy, and it was just super cool to be able to meet with him today. So
cool stuff. So enjoy the interview, guys. I think it'll be great. As always, send your questions for next week's show. Ride safe, and we will talk to you soon. So when we started this podcast, what feels like a million years ago, there were a few people who were like, "We'd be so cool to do a podcast, get a few people on here." We're finally starting to round out that first round of people we really wanted to talk to. And Art O'Connor, better known by his superhero name, Wukar, to many of you, or if you're at all active on Strava leaderboards in the Salt Lake City area, Art is one of those people where if there's like a good, impressive cyclist, Art has probably played some role in their development. We could go over the list, but just like the big name ones, Keegan, Sophia, your Alex Grants, all of these kind of wizards of the local cycling scene that we love to claim as our own, you know, Utah superheroes.
And pretty much any of the like the Nike superstars, Art's been involved with their training at some point or another. Who are we missing, Art?
Oh God, locally.
just like people we'd know, you know.
Yeah, Bart. I've worked with Bart.
And Alex.
I go way back.
Alex Grant. Yeah. I remember the first time I came in to meet Art. Alex Grant was there working out. I'm like, okay,
yeah, okay,
this
sold.
Guy's legit.
I'm curious, like when you introduce yourself at parties, what do you say? Is like, do you think of yourself mostly as a trainer? I assume like. How do you explain what you do to people?
Strength coach is what I say.
Strength coach.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, trainer has, I don't know, some. It's in this influencer culture we have, like trainer to me has somewhat of like a non-serious or somewhat negative connotations in my mind sometimes, where strength coach kind of really gets down to what I do.
And I was curious too, like as a strength coach, because you don't just do cycling. Right, like there are people with different athletic backgrounds that work with you, right?
Yeah, I've worked with schemo athletes, runners, and then just general fitness people as well. I have, you know, a fair clientele with that. People that are just trying to get fit, like, you know, business people. That, like, I have a long-standing client that comes almost every day at 6 a.m. who's a very high performer in his professional life, and he really loves and he's a cancer survivor, so he puts a premium on his health, and he says it makes him more money, which... Good
hey,
for him. Yeah,
that's so. Probably true. I think being alive and healthy is a great way to, you know, stay ahead in different parts of your life. But it's not just a bike thing for you. So you wouldn't say I'm a strength coach for cyclists. You are just a strength coach for a lot of people, and a lot of them happen to be cyclists, right?
Exactly, and that's probably what most people know me for, like in the, you know, the social media world or like that. And it's what I'm most passionate about. I mean, I'm passionate about all my clients, but, you know, cycling is near and dear to my heart, so that's what I really get excited about.
And how did you land in this industry? Like, what is your educational and professional background before this?
So I have a degree in exercise physiology from the University of Utah, go Utes. And I've always been coaching people on the side, like since I graduated, which was more than a few years ago at this point.
You got the 10-year reunion coming up, right?
Yeah, the 10-year reunion of my 30-year, something like that. But I've always kind of worked with people on the side, and I started doing this full time in about 2012, left a corporate job to get out of the cubicle and do something that I felt was more meaningful and didn't want to make me hit the snooze bar in the morning. But I was introduced to strength training as an athlete. Ski racing was my first passion, and I was really lucky to have some really good coaches early on. And my first ski coach was this kind of legendary figure in New England named Warren Cochran, who was really into barbell training, and all three of his boys were on the U.S. ski team, so they were like my idols growing up, and I was lucky enough to be coached by Warren, and he got me into strength training as an eighth grader when I was, you guys can't see me, but I'm a tall, skinny guy, and I was a really, really tall, skinny kid, so I always wanted to be stronger and get, and, you know, look like Schwarzenegger like every skinny kid. Never got to that point, but it helped me in all my athletic endeavors from that point on. So I was hooked on barbell training from an early age.
And when did you land in cycling?
So I started riding bikes. I was a track and field athlete at the University of Utah, and a number of injuries, knees and lower back stuff, kind of got me out of running. And I started riding a bike to rehab from running and found out I was pretty good at it and really liked it. And it's kind of right place, right time. Late 80s, early 90s, mountain biking was really booming. I would liken it to like what the gravel scene is now, where there was just a lot of media, a lot of hype, and a lot of opportunity for athletes. You know, it was easy to get sponsored, and there were a lot of great events. And so I kind of jumped into that right place, right time, and, you know, had some success there. And it's just, you know, I kind of joke that everything good in my life has come from riding bikes.
Oh, I say that, I'm not even
yeah,
joking.
It's not a joke, but it's like, other than my wife doesn't ride bikes, but she has been such a supporter of me and allowed me to do this when I quit my job in 2012 to pursue strength training. She did a lot of the heavy lifting in our relationship in terms of taking care of bills and that sort of stuff. So I'm very, very grateful to have that kind of support.
Because that's a wide, that's a, I mean, not a stab in the dark, but like leaving a job where there's all the stability to do something in the more passionate. I think a lot of people kind of dream of doing that, but never do. And more than a decade on, can you say that like that was the right move and that you feel really good about it?
It absolutely was for me. And again, like I've kind of Forrest Gumped my way into a lot of things in my life. And and I was in the right place, right time with strength training when it came to cycling. You know, I was kind of, I started doing, you know, the strength training stuff with just kind of general fitness clients. And I was trying to get cyclists in here. And with some, you know, like Alex and Bart were kind of early adopters and Matt O'Ran. You know, and I think they were more doing it because they were trying to support a friend, which I appreciate that. And then right before the 2016 Olympics, Nino Schurter released this video series where it went through one of his gym workouts.
I remember this. I did those every night for a while.
Yeah, it was like almost overnight my phone started ringing from cyclists who wanted to start training with me. And that's about when I started working with Maybird that first year. It was about that.
Yeah,
about that time. And you guys have, you know, Maybird in general has really helped me. You guys got my name out there, and you know, I was fortunate enough to work with a lot of the great athletes. And
it was actually Drew Free that told me about you.
Yeah, and Drew was one of the early people that started coming as well. So yeah, I mean, again, right place, right time, and you know, I had a particular skill set that was, you know, in demand.
And so I wonder, like, I think a strength training, like you said, with that Nino thing in 2016 is not something that's immediately obvious to all cyclists. And I think a lot of recreational cyclists don't do strength training. Mm-hmm. What is your elevator pitch when you're talking to someone like, oh, well, I ride and I want to get good and I want to win some I-Cups or whatever, but I don't really strength train. What is your kind of elevator pitch for why you should?
I have a really simple, I answer, which is super annoying, I answer their question with a question. I say, well, do you know of any sport where being weaker is better?
I was hoping you'd, that was the line I was trying to bait out of you here. I was trying to 60 minute that line out of you.
Yeah.
Because I've thought about that a lot too, that like, I kind of had the opposite thing to you where I was like the kid where I wished I was tall and skinny and stuff. Mm-hmm. And there was this, I don't know how much you'll laugh when I say this, like this ridiculous part of me where I'm like, I'm already too big. I'm trying to get smaller. I don't want to spend any time in the gym, right? Like all my friends weigh 100 pounds and I weigh 170, 180 in high school, right? Like I could be big overnight if I wanted to, but like being, and would you agree that there are probably very few successful pros who aren't doing some kind of strength training because just being stronger is better, right?
At this point, for sure, especially in the off-road scene. But even at the World Tour level, those guys are doing a lot more strength training than they let on. And it's like you see this evolution in a lot of sports. Like it wasn't that long ago where baseball players didn't lift weights because they thought it would ruin their swing or they wouldn't, you know, ruin the way they throw the ball. And basketball, same thing. Like all these sports that have been holdouts that are, you know, really old traditional sports have gradually kind of come around. And, you know, I can't think of a single sport now where strength training really isn't done at the highest level.
So, do you think that the strength training, like recommending someone to do strength training, would be like a holistic thing, or is it something that could actually make them faster?
That's a tough question to answer because it's, I wish it was that easy to where I could say, yeah, if you can deadlift 300 pounds, you're going to be pushing 6 watts per kilo at your FTP. It would make my job really easy. And, but it's, yeah, it's more of a holistic thing. It's just another piece of the puzzle. You know, with, you know, to compete at the highest level, everything has to be dialed. You have to have proper nutrition. You got to be getting proper sleep, getting, you know, proper recovery, the right equipment. So it's the higher you go in the sport, the more those things matter. You know, you can get to a pretty decent level pretty quickly just based on raw talent. But, you know, I'm sure you've seen it with your program. You can have like the most talented kid in the world, but if they don't take that extra step to go the extra mile, they're not going to get to that next level, even though they probably physically have the capabilities to do so. So I see strength. You know, I'm lucky in that I get to work with some really high level athletes, and they, you know, they talk about the stuff that I do with them, and you know, they say it's important, but it, like, I'm just happy to play a role in their success. you know, those guys are doing and girls are doing a whole lot of other work besides my strength training workouts to get them where they're going. But it's definitely a piece of the puzzle.
But you definitely don't see a lot of people that are hugely successful right now that are neglecting the strength aspect of it. So, and I think with these people, like, if it didn't in some way make them faster, they probably wouldn't bother with it as much. It's, I just don't think it's a coincidence. Like, it almost seems like, as far as training is concerned, that strength training is probably the biggest recent change to training principles I've seen.
In endurance sports, absolutely. Yeah. And to your point, like, if it didn't work, the top people wouldn't be doing it. You know, the World Tour teams wouldn't have strength coaches. You know, the world, like, guys like Nino on the World Cup circuit wouldn't be lifting weights if they weren't seeing the benefit of it. You know, Keegan wouldn't be lifting weights if he didn't feel like it made him faster. Same with Sophia, all those top riders. You know, they see the importance of it, and they make the time for it. You know, it's an important part of their schedule.
So how could you do it wrong would be my question. Like, if you are there ways that strength training could hinder your performance?
Absolutely. You know, in endurance sports, you know, the volume of training that you need to be successful, your strength training can't interfere with that. At the end of the day, you're a bike racer. You're not training to win the CrossFit Games. So if you're going to the gym and just smashing yourself to the point where you're having a hard time walking the next day, you're probably not going to be performing very well on the bike that next day, probably for the even worse the day after that, because you're way sore the second day after a workout. So with your strength training, you want it to complement and support what your bike racing's doing. So somebody like tip of the spear, like Keegan, you know, he does 2 to 3 days a week, 3 days more in the off season and 2 days a week, but his workouts are short. They're very directed and they're very focused. You know, he's in there for, you know, 20 to 40 minutes and he's done. So there's not a huge metabolic cost for him to do those workouts. We're really more training like your central nervous system and really trying to recruit those fast twitch muscle fibers. So the workouts are very specific and they're very short. So there's not a lot to recover from so that he can, you know, do the miles and the hours that they need on the bike. So if you're doing a CrossFit workout, you know, you'll get faster for a while, but at some point that's going to catch up with you. You know, with everything, there's beginner gains. Like if you've never lifted weights before in your life and you start going to the gym, you're going to improve really quickly for a while. But if you continue to do that, it's going to catch up with you and you're going to start slowing down. So at some point, you've got to be really purposeful in your strength training.
And you kind of alluded to something there I wanted to ask you about. Like, is there a relationship between strength and size?
I mean, there's a well-known principle called the size principle in strength training. So, you know, the bigger the cross-section of the muscle, the more available muscle fibers there are to recruit for a given thing. So I'm a big believer in being strong enough for your sport. So cycling, you know, even when you're sprinting like a max sprint, you're not putting that much force on the pedals in terms of like trying to equate it to like a leg press or a deadlift or a squat or something like that. You're using a very small fraction of your available strength for that. What strength training gives you is that durability and that repeatability, because as we know, cycling is a power sport. It's very seldom that you do a single attack and you just ride away for nobody ever sees you again. It's usually a series of attacks or sprints or whatever. So you'll need to have that repeatability and that durability to do that over and over again to be a successful cyclist. And that's one of the things that strength training does, is it teaches us to recruit those fast twitch muscle fibers, which as endurance athletes are kind of neglected to a certain degree. That's why we do sprint intervals on the bike, even if, you know, mountain bike races seldom end in a massive field sprint, but you need to have that explosive power. I mean, sprint in a mountain bike race is the start. It's the opposite of a road race. You're sprinting off the start.
Does strength training do anything for your type 1 muscle fibers?
It does. I mean, the human body is really efficient, almost to the point of being lazy. Like, it's only going to commit the least amount of resources possible to a given task. So if you have an untrained person and you tell them to do like a max, like bicep curl, for example, you're mostly, if it's a light, you're going to start off with those slow twitch fibers. And as it starts to get hard, then it's, your brain is sending the signal like, hey guys, we need a little help here. You'll start to recruit more fast twitch muscle fibers. But in an untrained person, you're only going to recruit maybe 15 to 18% of available muscle fibers for a given task, a max effort task like that. Through training, we can get that up in the 30, 35% range. And that's about it. Which may not sound like much, but we're almost doubling our effort just going from, you know, from 18 to 35%. So the only way, there's other ways to do it besides strength training to get that recruitment, like plyometrics, sprint training on the bike, but it's really hard to do that on the bike because you just can't produce that amount of overload as easily as you can just by moving a heavy weight.
So kind of what I'm hearing is you're almost being able to do more with the same muscles you've already got just by...
Yeah, because cycling is a strength to weight sport. You know, watts per kilo is the magic formula that, excuse me, that we're all chasing. So we don't want to gain necessarily muscle size because we have to drag that up the mountain with us. But that said, you know, so, like Keegan has put on a few pounds of muscle since he started working with me, but his watts per kilo has also gone up with that. So it's not a detriment to him. He's faster because of it. But at a certain point, you know, if he put on 15 pounds of muscle, the amount of watts he'd have to put on top of it, you know, what he currently has to sustain that, that's a whole lot harder to get to.
And I'm curious because I think the exposure to strength training that a lot of our athletes, and maybe in particular the boys, have had is, for me at least, the algorithm has figured out that I'm an exercise person, mm-hmm. and so it's constantly feeding me these like jack dudes talking about, oh, if you're not seeing the gains in the gym, if you still look like a twig, you're doing this and this wrong. Like, philosophically, in the way you approach strength training, you are maybe in kind of the minority of strength trainers where the point isn't to make you, you know, big and huge, right?
Right.
Is there like, what are the critical differences in your approach as like, or at least for a cyclist, like training a cyclist as opposed to just trying to make a guy look good in the mirror?
So it's very different types of training to train for a hypertrophy or muscle growth. I like using those fancy words.
I have the hardest time saying that word.
It is a hard word. It kind of gets tongue tied on.
I never feel like I'm saying it right.
Yeah. It's, you're training to failure for the most part. And the research is really ambiguous. They say anywhere between 5 and 30 reps is the ideal rep range.
Whoa.
So that's not super helpful, but the key is training to failure. With my athletes, we never train to failure. We're always training with reps in reserve. So like if I'm telling somebody to do like a 5x5 deadlift session, we want to pick a weight that they're finishing that fifth rep, knowing they probably could have done 2 to 3 more reps with the same form and the same bar speed. So we're leaving some in the tank. So we're working hard enough to get the adaptations that we want, but we're not emptying the tank and triggering a hormonal response that's going to cause muscles to grow. And also with the amount of on-bike training that you should be doing if you're competing at a high level, you're just not going to be able to put on much muscle because the amount of calories that you'd have to eat to support that is just unsustainable. When you're trying to put on size, you really have to eat like it's your job. You need to be eating a lot of quality protein, good carbohydrates, and good fats. At a gym I used to work at, we had a guy who was played for the Philadelphia Eagles. He's a wide receiver, and he wasn't a very big guy. Naturally, he was, you know, 5'8 or something like that. And I think when he started in the NFL, he was about 165, 170 pounds, and they wanted him to get up to about 185, 190. And he was working with one of the trainers there, a guy named Bobby Maximus, who was a UFC fighter, and he's like the epitome of a big jack dude. And Bobby was his trainer, and he was giving him a meal plan. And I remember him calling Rob on the phone one day, like, Rob, I can't eat anymore. I'm so, like, it's physically hard for me to eat. And Rob's like, well, then don't play in the NFL, and just hung up on him. Like, you know,
oh,
like, you've got to do this. Like, this
such a different problem.
I was going
to
say, maybe
I
should do the NFL.
Yeah.
Wrong sport.
Yeah. So, like, it's just, you're not going to put on a lot of mass. Even if you trained like a bodybuilder as a cyclist, if you're doing everything you should do on the bike, you're just sending really confusing signals to your body, first of all.
You know,
but you're not going to be doing the calories to support
that. It's funny. This is just like a random memory that just came to my head as we were talking about football players. I remember I was like in a convenience store or something on a vacation, and there are these kids that you could obviously tell were high school football players.
Mm-hmm.
And I just overheard their conversation, and they were like purposely trying to put on all this weight, like get fat.
Yeah.
And they were pretty plump people. and their plan was, is once they put on all this weight, they're getting stronger underneath all that, having to carry around all that body weight. And then they lose the weight. And then they would just be stronger. And
care to comment on that as a strategy?
Yeah, don't do that.
I'm kind of like, huh, maybe that's one way
PhD,
to live your life.
Like science trainer was like, this is all the research.
I'm sure that was some TikTok science that taught him that. But
right.
Yeah. I don't.
Yeah. Well, that's not to say that cyclists don't eat a lot of food, because they definitely do. Like, you know, I weigh like, what, 70 maybe 80 pounds more than Keegan, but that guy can eat me under the table any day of the week. Like, it's amazing. Like, if he ever retires from cycling, he probably has a career in competitive eating in front of him if he really wanted to go that way. But, you know, someone like that, he's, you know, 25, 35 hours a week on the bike. You know, you have to eat that much just to sustain that. You know, and he's not putting on weight doing that.
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't look at him and you're like, oh man, he needs to, you know, like you look at him and it almost would seem like he'd be starving himself, but to sustain the ridiculous amount of work you're doing.
Yeah.
It's like he's almost trying to feed a forest fire.
Sure. And all those top level pros are like that. Like they can put away the food, you know, and it's really impressive.
So this is kind of a little bit unrelated. I just need to ask because it's a little controversial is, do you recommend that people use creatine?
I personally use it. I feel like I get more of a cognitive benefit than I do for, like, I definitely feel a difference in the gym. Like, if I take, I take 5 grams a day, but I've had a number of concussions, and there's some pretty clear science that it's really good for recovering from concussions and head injuries. So that's the biggest reason I take it. As far as like the pros I work with, I don't really go into nutrition, because that's a whole other can of worms that I'm really not qualified to talk about. And most of them work with a nutritionist. So I mean, creatine is probably the most studied and safest supplement that's out there. The only downside for cyclists is you do tend to retain water when you take it, so it makes you heavier, but I don't really think that it's a performance decreaser, because you're just retaining more water, and water is actually good for us, as particularly in like gravel and these ultra long events. Like, having a little more water packed into your cells probably isn't a bad thing necessarily. Maybe for a race like Crusher, which is basically, you know, a 5-hour hill climb, you don't want to be carrying a whole lot of water in that. But it's as they say, do your own research. Like, it's a very safe supplement. Like, there's, you know, you can't overdose. You're not going to die off of it. But I don't think you need as much. You definitely don't need, like, bodybuilder doses and the loading phase that bodybuilding is kind of famous for. You definitely don't need that as an endurance cyclist. You know, 5 grams a day is probably all you really need. You will feel a difference in the gym and doing explosive stuff. But as far as a performance benefit on the bike, the jury's kind of still out on that. There's no real evidence that suggests that it's a performance enhancer for ultra distance stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But for like doing like sprint workouts on the bike, you definitely feel a difference when you're doing it. So from a training standpoint, like, using it strategically is probably not a bad thing.
Okay.
How often is the science moving on stuff like this? Because we've talked before about like, exercise science is not pharmaceutical science. Like, it's, we don't have the same resources being thrown at some of these questions. In maybe just the time since the kind of 2016 boom, you know, 10-ish years on, do you see huge shifts with, you know, like, the way that you approach things? Or are you doing 50% of the same things you were back then, or 98% of the same things?
No. So science is kind of a lagging indicator in that it kind of proves things that we already know.
Especially in coaching.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the principles of strength training are pretty well established and have been around for a very long time. Like the stuff that like Schwarzenegger and those guys were doing in like the silver era of bodybuilding, like there was no science to back that up, but it clearly worked. I mean, yeah, there were some pharmaceutical enhancements that those guys were using as well. But, you know, you can take all the performance enhancing drugs in the world, but if you're not training right, you're not going to get the benefit of them. You know, the things that they were doing, like supersetting and things like that, you know, it took a long time before there was any real science that said, oh, yeah, this works. But, like, obviously we know it works. And in cycling, you know, you just look at, like, what the World Tour team guys are doing, and you can draw a pretty clear conclusion, like, all right, this works because it's working for these guys. And, yeah, maybe they're taking some things that you and I aren't taking, but that's, people make a bigger deal. I mean, yeah, you shouldn't take drugs, you shouldn't cheat, of course. But at the same time, if you're not doing the proper training, doesn't matter what you're going to be taking, the training always comes first. And so I don't like the in everything, the basics always work. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what I see across every sport. Like the best people in the world have mastered the basics to a level that, you know, the dilettante has not. Because, you know, I'm a recreational cyclist at this point. You know, I'm 58 years old. My days of winning pro bike races are well in the rearview mirror.
Can I just say you don't look 58?
That number did surprise me. I was like, oh, really? Like,
really?
Yeah. I'm like, man, Dan, you look like trash. Yeah. Like, there's no way.
You look more 48, so you've got a free 20 years there somehow.
Thank you. But, you know, I fall into the same trap of, like, I see, you know, these Instagram workouts and stuff and, like, you know, the hacks and things like that. Those things don't work. Like, the hacks don't work. Like, I always say hacks are for hacks.
You know, that's good. That's really good.
You know, the basics always work. If you look at, like, what the top-level pros do in cycling, it's a lot of the same workouts and just, you know, a lot of just putting in the miles on the bike. There's no, like, secret workout.
Oh, man, I am just always looking for that magic secret formula.
We always are.
The bicycling magazine, GCN, this one magic interval will, you know, like our version of clickbait in the cycling.
Yeah, like, you know, the Norwegian method or whatever, you know, it's like that stuff. Yeah. Does it work? Of course it works. But like there's no magic to it. It's, they're just doing the work.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, because I don't know if we flatter ourselves as cycling thinking there's this huge diversity of different events, but someone approaching you saying, I want to win Nike State Champs versus I want to win Cross States versus I want to go and win Unbound or I want to go do the Race Across America. Like, how much does like your training for someone change based on the kind of intensity versus duration of the event that they're doing?
Honestly, that's one of the reasons why I just do strength training and I don't focus on the ride stuff, because strength training is pretty universal across the board for me. Yeah, I mean, somebody that's training for Unbound probably doesn't need to work on the explosiveness as much as like somebody that's doing Nike races or XCO stuff that, you know, they're like, you know, 120, like 90 minutes to maybe 2 hours on the high end of things. You know, this strong is strong. So I focus on strength training because I understand it, and it's also, to me, it's a lot less complicated than trying to come up with an interval plan or, you know, structure the different bike.
We'll talk about that in a second, but I definitely disagree right there.
Seems like, because it does seem like the strength training, I could, if a kid came to me and was like, I want to get faster on the bike, I could give him the basics of like, here's here's what you do on the bike or whatever. Strength training to me does seem like black magic.
Well, and like, that's what I was going to say. Whenever anyone asks me questions about strength training,
like, I don't know.
My response is always, I know enough to be dangerous.
My response is always basically your name. I'm like, go talk to Art. I don't know.
And I was going to talk about that more towards the end, but there's definitely wrong ways to do things, and I could show you the wrong ways for sure, you know. But really, the like all the movements and so forth that are incorporated have to be done right, mm-hmm. or else it can be really dangerous.
And not to make this like a shameless plug for you, but like you see the video, and I'm sure you see them on Instagram all the time, of people with just terrible, terrifying form when they're lifting. And this is why I don't tell kids, like, oh, we'll just go in the basement and do it on your own. Right. Like, this is the value of paying for someone who knows what they're doing, right? Because what you do, there is some danger involved with, like, lifting, right?
No, absolutely, there is. I mean, the form, yeah, the form is crucial. Like, that's my number one rule, is don't get hurt in the gym. We're in a dangerous sport where you're going to get hurt on your bike at some point, and we accept that risk because it's part of the sport.
Right.
There's no reason to get hurt in the gym. Like, I don't test one rep maxes with any of my athletes. We'll do a 3-rep test or a 5-rep test, and we can estimate it, because we don't need to be precise, because again, we're not trying to win weightlifting competitions. We just want to be strong on the bike, and being strong, like going back to that concept of being strong enough. Like, if you can deadlift 1.5 times your body weight to 2 times your body weight, you don't need to be any stronger than that to pedal a bike. You know, if you can crank out, 15 push-ups as a guy and, 5 to 10 pull-ups, like, you're good. You don't need to be any stronger than that. In fact, to get much stronger than that means you have to really buckle down on the gym stuff and focus on that to get to that next level, which means less time on the bike. But just like the on-bike stuff, we always want to overcomplicate things. And it's like, at the end of the day, you do a lot of quality, aerobic work. You throw in, some VO2 stuff when you get close to your A events. You do a lot of, a lot of tempo, a lot of threat. It's, I always say good training is boring.
Yes.
It really
is. Secrets out of the bag right there.
Yeah. And the same thing in the gym. Like, my programs are really basic. I don't have a lot of what I call like Instagram exercises. We do, deadlifts, squats, lunges, overhead presses, push-ups, pull-ups. That's about it. And we do a lot of them, and we do it over and over again. And that's another thing that I find the difference between an elite level person and somebody that's just getting into it. There's a temptation as coaches, that we almost feel like we need to entertain our athletes and throw a bunch of different stuff at them. But the best people in the world do the same things over and over again, day in, day out, year in, year out. And that's how you get really good, is you just get really good at the things that matter.
Mm-hmm. How does strength training change as the season progresses?
'Cause we had somebody ask this, like Riker on the team asked, like, through, 'cause cycling, especially in Utah, is a very seasonal thing. I would say there's the kind of flow of the season that a lot of people maybe hit a couple I cups in March, season gets busier through the summer, tails down into the fall, maybe hit some cross, and then you're back into the winter, right? Like, and we were talking as we were setting up the mics that your business is cyclical like that, that you're busier right now than you are in July, right?
Did you say setting up the bikes?
Setting up the bikes. I only know about one thing. I only know one noun. I don't know a lot of nouns. Setting up the mics, excuse me.
Yeah.
But how do you, and maybe even with a Keegan and then with like an amateur, vary that through the year? And then when you've got like, Keegan, you said it's twice a week, but if it's Unbound tomorrow, he's probably not lifting the day before, right?
No, like race week, he'll do a workout like on Monday or Tuesday, and then he's got plenty of time to recover for the event. But you want to periodize your training just like you do on the bike. It's like, we have a base phase in the gym, we have a strength phase, and then we have a power phase, and then we go into our in season. So base is just like it is on the bike. We're just training to train. We're doing lower weights, higher reps, spending more time in the gym, because if it coincides with your bike season, it's, you're starting that kind of in the off season where you're probably not on the bike very much, or if you are, it's really unstructured. And then you start your base training and you're starting to, you're doing big miles, big hours, but at a really low intensity. Same idea in the gym. Then we move into more of a strength phase where we're trying to get as strong as we possibly can during that strength block, and that can be anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks. Then we shift into power, which strength is more about generating force, whereas power is the rate of force development. So
you want
to be able to go from like 0 to 60 really quickly. So then we go to a lighter weights and moving it faster. So that's where we you know, like you've done, we do a lot of box jumps and,
oh, yeah.
and plyometrics and things like that during that phase, but the weights are light and we're moving them very quickly and we're taking really long recoveries in like 2 to 3 minutes between sets. And then in season is kind of a combination of the two. We still do a lot of power stuff. And well, with like the Grand Prix athletes, they have pretty long blocks between their races. So they can do like these little mini strength cycles in them. And I'll do that with a lot of my athletes if they're just doing the Grand Prix stuff. Some of them are doing other races in between. But for the most part, they're like the guys and girls are at the pointy end of things in the Grand Prix. They're not doing a whole lot of racing outside of the Grand Prix stuff because just the stakes are too high for the Grand Prix. They have to be ready for that. So we'll do some more focused like strength stuff in the summer, whereas somebody that's racing every weekend, like in the local series or things like that, we're just going to be doing more maintenance type work. So primarily more power focus just to keep that fast twitch muscle fibers on engagement online. And then we have an off season, just so it's really, it kind of mimics what we're doing on the bike in terms of how we're periodizing things.
And then how do you know you're not kind of overloading somebody? Like do you just kind of coordinate with the athlete, or do you coordinate with their coach, or
depends? Both usually. Some of the athletes that I work with, I mean, all of them, like I don't write the riding programs for any of the pros that I work with. Very few of their coaches I talk with very often. They can see the workouts because I just put them in Training Peaks. Mm-hmm. But it's mostly communicating with the athlete. So like when a professional cyclist tells me they're tired, I take that really serious because it's hard to get those guys and girls tired.
For that, right?
Yeah.
But my program's been refined over the years that I don't get those calls very often anymore. We're trying to, like, cycling is a sport of extremes. Like, it takes big hours and things like that. And so we have to be good. And so we have, a lot of people have this idea of more is better, but really what we're trying to find the minimum effective dose more so than the maximum effective dose. So especially in the strength and the maintenance phases, you should be leaving the gym almost with more energy than when you started.
Okay.
So it's really about just kind of waking you up and getting your central nervous system online and priming you for your on-bike stuff the following day.
Kind of like we talked a little bit earlier, how you're really just like teaching yourself to recruit more motor units and,
mm-hmm.
and it almost seems like that's kind of more of a skill that you just need to keep reminding yourself how to do that, I guess, is kind of maybe a way to look at it.
It exactly is. I mean, so Pavel Satsulin is one of the guys that I follow really closely. He's basically the guy who brought kettlebells to America. He's a Russian master of sport. And that's one of his saying is strength is a skill. And that's what he teaches in his organization, Strong First. And that's what I tell my riders, like, think of this as skills training. Like, just like where you go out and practice cornering or, practice going over obstacles or bunny hopping. This is skills training. You're learning the skill of strength.
Yeah, and kind of along the skill thing and the technique thing, like for me, who knows like very little about strength training. So like when I go to do like a trap bar deadlift or something, mm-hmm. a lot of times it'll hurt my back.
Yeah.
And I've got some theories why that might be. One, I probably haven't done enough lightweight to get good form.
Mm-hmm.
Two, it might be my core is not strong enough. What do you think that might be,
diagnose this without seeing it, Art.
Yeah.
Or you can just see what the kids say and just say skill issue,
Yeah, I mean, do you think that's probably just a technique issue, or is it that my core is not strong enough, or that
it can be all of those things. And it's also, I love deadlifts. They're a great movement, but honestly, they're not for everybody. Some people just shouldn't do deadlifts. They should be doing other things, particularly if they've been working at it for a while and they're chronically having issues with their back. It's more often a case of they're doing something technically wrong that's causing them to overload their back in a way, but it also could be just You know, some backs just don't hold up to what's called shear force. When you're lifting like that, your vertebrae kind of, instead of stacking on each other, they kind of move back and forth, which is not good. And that's just like, you know, some people have loose joints, and that, you know, your back is a joint. So I would definitely want to see you lift. But the other thing is, you may be just trying to lift too much for what you're ready for. Because to your point, like in my programs, I don't have a lot of like dedicated core training, because everything that we're doing requires good core engagement. So that's why we do front squats as opposed to back squats. Because if you're holding a kettlebell in front of you for a goblet squat, I don't even need to give you the cue to brace your core, because you have to hold, you have to have your core engaged just to be holding that. And then, and like this, the split squats and the lunges that we do, all of that stuff requires a lot of dynamic engagement in your core, that the farmer carries and all the heavy carries that we do train that stuff. But that's, I would say, you know, without seeing you, focus a little bit more on core strength and come in and we'll do a session and I'll watch you deadlift and figure out what's going wrong.
And that's right there is kind of the main reason you really need an expert like Art, you know, 'cause I've tried to like watch YouTube videos and all this stuff. And, you know, and I know a decent amount about exercise and all this kind of stuff. And I haven't been able to figure it out on my own, you know? And so I think that's why, you know, people that know what they're doing are really valuable in this arena, because, you know, you don't want to mess up your back. You don't want to get, no. You know, this should help you. A hurt back doesn't make anyone faster, for sure.
No,
it can cost you several training weeks too, you know? So.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm dealing with, you know, lifelong back issues from an injury I originally got in college because I was lifting too heavy, that, you know, lifting a weight that I wasn't ready for because I was showing off for the cute girl that was in the gym.
Was it worth it all these years, Han? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, we're really good friends to this day, but she never dated me, so I don't know.
It's worth it though, right?
Yeah, totally.
I'm curious, like, are there differences, like training guys and girls with the strength training, or is it about the same in your strength arena at least?
I mean, it's similar. Like, women have to spend a little more time working on their upper body strength just because they don't carry as much muscle mass naturally. So, you know, pull-ups, for women to learn pull-ups, they have to have really good form to kind of make up for the lack of muscle mass that they naturally don't have compared to guys. Like, if you ever want to see like really good, perfect pull-ups, watch a girl that's good at pull-ups and you'll see really good form because they've had to learn
by necessity,
that way.
Huh?
Yeah, like a lot of guys are strong enough to just make pull-ups a bicep exercise and they never learn how to recruit their lats or retract their scapula and get their core properly engaged to do it. But if you don't have that advantage, you have to learn proper form to do it. So, and like all the moves that we do in the gym, like, you know, a deadlift is a very safe movement if it's done properly and you're not trying to do a weight that you're not ready for. You know, squats, you know, that's another reason I like goblet squats, is because it's very unlikely you're going to be able to lift a kettlebell and hold it in place that's too heavy for you to squat.
Yeah.
You know, whereas a barbell or a back squat, you can put a ton of weight on the bar, get it off the rack and not realize it's too heavy for you until you go down and don't come back up.
Ooh. Is there like what's the worst injury you've seen in the gym before? Like not even just like coaching, but just being in gyms for as many years as have you seen some of the really bad consequences with the pride lifting and stuff, or?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen some really bad back injuries. Honestly, the worst injury I've ever seen was with box jumps.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We have soft-sided boxes here, so if you miss, it's pretty low consequence. Yeah. But I've seen people on wooden or metal boxes where they miss and, like, drag their shins down there and, like, literally remove, like, down to the bone from, like, their ankle to their knee. I've seen that. It's not pretty.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, because I remember the first time coming here, even doing just like the basic bike program here, I was still a little nervous because I'd been a cyclist by riding a bike. That's it, right? And coming here, but I do want to say, and like, again, and you're too humble to plug your thing. I'll plug it for you. Like, this was the most easy, non-scary. Like, I imagine the gym. I think there's this kind of thought from what you see on the internet that, like, gym is a scary place. Mm-hmm. This was an uncomfortable place a lot of the time. And you're great at that, too. But there, I appreciated the kind of approach of, like, don't go crazy. Just, like, do, you know, stay within your limits. Do it safely. Focus on the form. So I think if there's anybody listening who has maybe some resistance to this because it just sounds intimidating, I don't know how other gyms go, but this one was just a lovely place to be. I was never scared of, well, I was scared of parts of it, but not like, you know, I wasn't scared for
well,
my
most,
safety.
Well, most kids do it because they think it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, but, yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. And like, I do a lot of online programming. Like, people will buy one of my programs online. And if they're local, and I know they're local, I always offer a free session to have them come in the gym and teach them the movement safely. And if they're not local, I really strongly encourage them to, like, go find a good powerlifting gym and learn how to deadlift, learn how to squat from the experts. And there's, like anything, there's good coaches and bad coaches. But just, you know, paying for a session to learn the proper form is going to pay you back.
Oh, yeah.
Just having someone that knows what they're doing actually watching you do it mm-hmm. and watching you do it wrong is huge, I think.
So. It's almost impossible to learn these things by just watching a video because, like, I did the same thing when I was learning how to kettlebell swing. You know, I watched a couple videos and ordered a kettlebell, and, you know, online. It came to my house, and I started doing kettlebell swings, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm killing this. I'm so good at these. And then I went to a kettlebell seminar, and the first thing they asked is, like, who here knows how to do a kettlebell swing? I put my hand up, and I go up to the front, and they're like, what is that? Like, where did you learn to do that? And I said, I actually learned it watching you online. And he was like, I was really hoping you'd say that. Because he's like, I have yet to see anybody that's taught themselves how to kettlebell swing just by watching a video. Because we kind of delude ourselves into thinking we're doing it perfectly. And unless we have someone that's watching us saying, no, you're rounding your back. You're making it a squat instead of a swing. You know, you're just not going to pick up on that stuff on your own.
I love the idea of a kettlebell seminar. That's very funny to me. You know, like, what are you catering this week? Oh, there's a kettlebell seminar. It's like a very specific kind of nerdy.
They go deep. Like, when you're learning a kettlebell swing at a kettlebell seminar, it's going to be like noon before you actually even do a swing. They break it down to the minutia. Like, it's really impressive, and you come away knowing what you're doing for sure. But yeah, the kettlebell people take it very, very seriously.
You don't
which
mess
they should,
with them,
because
right?
Like, you can really get hurt kettlebell training if you do it wrong.
This is, and not to change gears too drastically, but I am interested in you as like a almost like a philosopher in this arena, just because you're one of those people that's been around the block so many times and seen so much stuff. And I do want to ask you, and I know there's a million things we want to talk about. You, I think, for some people might also be that guy I follow on Instagram who does that crazy thing in Alaska. could you talk a little bit? And I know that, like, we talk a little bit, like, we don't want to, like, fetishize pain and discomfort or whatever, but, like, that is insane. And I'm fascinated to be talking to what appears to be a sentient, conscious, rational human being who not only makes the choice, but I'd imagine also pays some money to do something like that. Maybe just could you explain what the iterod is and then why in God's name that is a choice you would make with your life?
Yeah, so the Iditarod Trail Invitational is the human-powered version of the Iditarod dog sled race. So we go on the same trail as the dogs. We go a week before the dogs. So we're kind of like, not really, they have their own trail setters, but we go a week before the dogs. I've only done the 350 miles. So we go from Kinnick Lake to McGrath. The full Iditarod Trail goes all the way to Nome. It's 1,000 miles. So we never see the dogs in the 350, but if you go to Nome, the dogs catch you. Even with a weak head start.
Are you, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, they finish in about 9 days, I think, the dogs do. And, like, the course record for Nome is 15 days. So the dogs catch you, which I want to go to Nome because I just want to get caught by the dogs and see those dogs go by because it sounds awesome.
We all want the same things in life, sure.
Yeah. But, you know, it was a process for me. I started, you know, I bought a fat bike. And there used to be a series here called the Frosty Series, and it was more like the iCup. They were like 90-minute races. And I started doing those, and they were pretty fun. And then I heard about this race up in Idaho called the Fat Pursuit. They have a 50K and a 200-kilometer race. I did the 50K And I did it in a year where it was minus 35 at the start. And I went up there not, like, I didn't have pogies. I borrowed some at the, you know, from guys I was staying with. They're like, you cannot go out there in this without pogies, which are the hand covers, or you're going to be in a world of hurt. So I borrowed all this stuff and I did it. And it was really slow. It was really cold. But I finished. I didn't have frostbite. And I was like, huh, this is pretty cool. But at that point, going further than that just wasn't on my radar at all. I did the 50K again the next year. It was much better conditions, and it was way more fun. And then a buddy of mine, you guys may know Jason Sparks. He was involved in, he's Box Elder Nika team. He did the 200-kilometer version like the year after that, and he won it. And I was thinking, all right, you know, Jason and I are pretty comparable. Maybe I should try this. So I signed up for the 200K, didn't finish. Like, I pulled out at the second checkpoint because it was snowing about 2 inches an hour. And I mean, I was in second place. I pulled into the checkpoint in second place behind this guy named Kurt Refsnyder, who's, look him up. If there's an ultra race, he's done it, won it, probably has the course record on it. So I was doing great, but I got to this checkpoint and we were supposed to go up over Two Top Mountain, which is kind of the big feature up there. It's dumping snow. I had all this fancy like snow camping gear that I had never used. Like, you have to have it to do this race. And I got there and I'm like, I'm going to go up over a mountain I've never seen before. My GPS is dead. And this is like 10 o'clock at night at this point. And I'm probably going to have, like, if I have to stop and camp, I have no idea what I'm doing. And so I pulled out, and that just made me mad. So then it was a matter of like, all right, I'm going to figure this out. So I signed up for this thing called Fat Camp. Jay Peterbury is the promoter of this race, and Jay has won the Iditarod, I don't know how many times. But he's won the 100, the 1,000 mile, the 350, and he does this thing called Fat Camp where he actually teaches you how to use all of your gear. So I signed up for that. We spent 3 days sleeping outside, setting up our bivvy, learning how to stay warm, boil water, keep yourself alive in really rugged conditions, and ended up finishing Fat Pursuit that year in second place, which was like, all right, this is pretty cool. And then started thinking about Iditarod, but it's like, nah, I still can't do that. Like, that's a whole other can of worms. But then, yeah, one thing led to another, and I found myself up there in Alaska for the Iditarod. And honestly, it was really hard, but it was, I mean, I'm not a real woo-woo guy, but it was honestly like almost like a spiritual experience, like just like shock and awe and wonder being out there, like just looking around thinking, here I'm in the middle of freaking Alaska on a bike. I got here under my own power. Like, how blessed am I to be able to even do this? And even though it was really hard and at times really uncomfortable, the whole time I was just like, just so filled with gratitude that I could even do such a thing. And I finished it, and you know, I've been back another time since. I'm going again this year, hopefully, if I can get my back issue sorted out. And it just, yeah, it was a progression and it was an evolution, and it's just something I love now. It's like, I'm not, you know, I'm in no danger of winning this thing at this point, but it's just an adventure that it's really hard to describe until you've been there.
Well, I think everybody who listens to this probably has, definitely more than the average person on the street, the experience of kind of finding a limit, that there is something about like, this is really far out from what I've ever done before. And like you said, it's uncomfortable. But it's also magical. And as much as when you're in that moment, you're like, I did like point to point for the first time this year. So yeah. I'm miles behind you. But anyway, for me, that was a big deal, right? And like the whole time I'm like, this is awful. This is as bad as anything could ever be. I don't ever want to do this again. I'm mad at the version of myself that did this. What an awful day. Right. But then you finish, you're like, there was these almost like, I think spiritual like seems like a heavy word to use for that, but it is, you know, there's something that you feel, or you're like, I need to do this again. The way that I feel right now is awesome, you know? Yeah. And that's probably, I do wonder that, like, once you do that, like, you can't really find, where do you, you know? Because there's like 12 levels of bigger high I could get from where I'm at. From where you're at, like, do you ride to Mars next? Or like, did you do like underwater? Like, once you've done the Iditarod, is there anything else that you progress to? Or do you just do that faster? Like,
Yeah, no, I mean, I actually want to do it slower, because the first year I did it and finished, like, I did a lot of night riding. And so I missed a lot of the cool stuff, because, like, you're, like,
right, yeah,
you know, you're riding at night. And so, right, like, I'm going back this year, and I'm doing the first 150 miles with my buddy Jason Munns. He's doing there's a 150-mile version now and a 350. He's doing the 150. So we'll ride together.
Was Jason from like Box Elder or something?
Yeah, he runs the Box Elder team.
He's got daughter. Like the barbell mustache.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I've actually became kind of iCup buddies with him recently.
Yeah, Jason's an awesome
He's
dude.
A cool guy, super yeah. cool guy.
And he's a big part of my fat bike journey. We stay in his cabin up at Island Park, and he's done Fat Pursuit a number of times. So I'm really looking forward to having that experience with him. And we've kind of already talked, like, we're going to minimize the night riding that we have to do, because we want to see it and we want to experience it. We're not there to win it. And then ultimately I really want to try to go to Nome. That's a big commitment. You know, that's a big ask, because it'll take me 20 plus days to get to Nome. So just taking that much time off of your life is
20 plus days on a bike.
On a bike. Yeah. And it's, you know, last year I saw like minus 30 at Iditarod, but if you go to Nome, you're going to see probably minus 40, minus 50. Like, it's, you know, the consequences are real.
That's just
if you screw up. But that said, you know, it sounds crazy, but once you understand how the system, you know, your clothing systems and your sleep systems work, like, it's amazing what you can get through and what you can tolerate. So it's, you know, but it takes a while to get there. You know, it's definitely a process, and it's definitely an evolution.
I love cycling, because there's always a bigger, crazier fish. Like, I think I'm a stud just going to like a normal job and being like, oh yeah, you know, I did this 9-hour mountain bike race in Park City. Like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. And then you talk to other people where it's like, yeah, you know, and then the snow monster came out of the woods and we had to run for 150 miles and there was a wizard and, I don't know. I just, the big respect. That seems like a really trivial thing to say, but that's cool.
It is cool that you also have to point that he built himself up to that.
Yeah,
you should sign up. If you're listening to this, don't sign up for that next year.
Well, you can't. You have to qualify for it. It's called an invitational, because you have to apply.
How many people do it?
There's 100 people, and that's you can walk it, ski it, or bike it. Just human powered.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's more bikers than anything else. But yeah, like, the people that walk it and ski it, like, I can't imagine that. Like, I think they're crazy. They think we're crazy. So it's like,
what flavor of crazy are you?
Yeah. Yeah. And ultimately it comes down to, like, how do you want to carry all your stuff? Like, you're either going to carry it in a sled skiing or walking, or you're going to strap it to a bike and carry all it. So you're just carrying stuff across Alaska. You're just choosing how you're going to carry your stuff, essentially.
This must be slightly insulting to the people who, like, had to do this. Like, so you're choosing to do this now? Like, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure the natives up there are like,
what is
white
this?
People.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's super cool. This has been really awesome. I hope you got through all your questions. I mean, there's no way you got through all your questions.
I didn't, actually. I'm going to ask, when we're offline, I've got a couple more for him, but.
This could be 7 hours long. I know we got to cut you off somewhere, but thank you so much for sharing. And I do want to plug one more time. Like, if people are interested in doing your program, I assume go, you know, check out your Instagram. I assume you look it up on the internet, you know, WUKAR Training, WUKAR.
And we'll send out some information. Yeah, we'll send out some more information.
Yeah, Instagram right now is my only, like, my website got hacked and I'm in the process of getting
that. Oh, shoot.
But
okay,
Instagram,
don't look them up
has,
on the internet.
Don't go to WUKAR.com right now, because it's not there. But WUKAR Fit, you can buy, like, all my programs are available on that. You can contact me through there. If you're local, I'd love to have you come in the gym and check things out. And also, I'd like to thank you guys. Like, what Maybird has done is really impressive. Like, you guys have produce some really impressive athletes and just some really impressive human beings. Like,
oh, thank you.
Like, it's not just about the bike, and you guys really care, and it shows.
Well, that That just means so much to me, Art. Thank you so much. Because, yeah, we...
I'll take credit for some fast kids. Yeah, that was all me, you know? Like, couldn't have done it without me, guys. You're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, there's just too many names to name over the years. But, like, some really, really impressive young men and women have come out of that program.
Well, that means a lot. Thanks, Art.
It's very kind of you. Yeah. So, yeah, one more time. Like, definitely check it out. You know, as I think a lot of us are kind of getting into the winter mode. This has been, you know, this was a game changer for me. Definitely be sure to check it out. I need to go do some reading on like Alaska bike racing. That's going to be my new like obsession. I'm supposed to.
I'm
be
just
doing
like, how
stuff.
Do you keep your feet warm? That's like
my feet.
I'm
feet
still
are,
trying to figure that out.
My feet are cold the, right now.
I'll be watching TV. I'm like, I'm a little chilly.
I have this rule that like if it's under 40 degrees, I ride inside.
Yo, yeah. I mean, if it's like negative 40, that's when Zwift gets your money, you know? Like,
yeah.
When hell literally freezes over.
Right.
Well, thank you again for your time. Like, I really appreciate it. It's been phenomenal. And Dan, I feel bad, Dan. We ask you 10 questions offline. We'll do like a special Patreon episode if you guys want to start paying for Maybird Plus to get all the follow-ups. But if you guys have any questions for us for next week's episode, be sure to send them our way. And thanks so much again, Art. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Keep doing what you're doing.
Talk to you soon.